It's really funny to like explore this space where we almost lost it all, and to be reconnecting and finding others who are also reconnecting, and we're just all just cheering each other on and celebrating that. And those moments are the most exciting parts of running the farm.
What does it take for a people to begin anew, to rebuild something that someone has tried to destroy, erase, and take away? This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. In 1956, as a part of its ongoing Holocaust against Indigenous peoples, the government of Canada declared the Saanai people to be extinct. But this is far from the truth. Regardless of whether it is acknowledged by the governments or courts, the Saanai and other people of the lakes in Canada and the U.S. are very much still here and are pushing to restore their status and identity and culture. Today, I'm talking to Michelle Week, a Saanai woman and first-generation farmer who runs Good Rain Farm. We talk about her work to recover and revitalize her traditional culture and how the farm fits into a vision of food sovereignty for her people and the region as a whole. Let's dig in. Today, I'm bringing you an interview that was originally recorded for the 2022 Arrowal Foods Summit in Toronto. My guest is Michelle Week, a farmer with Good Rain Farm, which is located just outside of Portland, Oregon. I'm really excited by this opportunity to speak with you, Michelle, about your farm, about your efforts, and your thoughts on food sovereignty and the future of our food in Canada. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's start. Perhaps you can tell me a little bit about how and why you came to start Good Rain Farm.
So I started Good Rain Farm because I wanted to do something actionable and tangible to support our community here and make an impact with the resources and the knowledge and the interests and the enthusiasm I had. I had grown up here in the Pacific Northwest. We're a very outdoorsy family. Grew up doing a lot of gardening and 4-H club activities, and just gravitated back towards that as something to do to give back. So we started with a really large garden, and that garden kept growing. And some folks found out about what we were doing and were really enthusiastic about supporting us and helping us get food to people. So we were showing up to free events to distribute our excess produce yields. And it just grew from there.
So starting this farm really has also been, if I understand correctly, quite a journey of reconnecting to place and to who you are. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Where we started farming was under a grove of Oregon white oaks, which are a declining ecology in the Northwest. And as I was farming there under these Oregon white oaks, I started to kind of think about them. Can you use their acorns? Can you eat those acorns? I think I've seen acorn flour in the store. So I started doing a lot more research and reconnecting and learning a lot about how the indigenous communities all up and down the region of the Oregon white oak, how they utilize those acorns, but also all these other plants and animals that came together under these big, large meadows, these savannas in the Northwest, and the key role that cultural burning played in under these trees, how it reinvigorated other foods and brought other animals in for easy hunting and gathering, and really diving deeper into that, which really brought me back to really consciously, actively reconnecting to my Saanai heritage and wanting to actively participate in our culture. And right around that time, we had learned my grandmother's part of the Kaville Confederate tribes. And she, for a long time, didn't know which of the 12 tribes of Kaville we were a part of. And when we learned that we were part of the Arrow Lakes or Saanai, when you Googled that a long time ago, we came up extinct. There wasn't a lot of info there, and we were considered extinct. And it was Another Sinai person from Kavil who went over the border into Canada and exerted their rights to food sovereignty and to access of traditional hunting grounds and hunted a moose, I believe it was, and went to court and battled for our existence.
What was that like? What is that like, knowing that your people have been described as extinct?
There are parts of my growing up that we always, you know, we knew that we were indigenous and whatnot, but it wasn't this active engagement that has really brought me to Husqvarna, to Good Rain Farm, and being able to really embrace our indigenous heritage and also continue to assert our continued existence and bring food to people in really equitable and ecologically sound ways that I can be really proud of. So that's kind of the long story of how I got started into the farm. Yeah, it kind of grew into this wild little beast I take care of now.
It's a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that with me. And it really is, there's so much to it. I wish we could spend all afternoon talking about it. I think one of the things that struck me when I first started reading about your farm is I feel like there's some special significance there. When one of the trends we're seeing around North America and other parts of the world is all this farmland being bought up, consolidated, a lot of people who are working land or working land that's rented to them, that's and large-scale investors, people like Bill Gates buying farmland is on the news. I noticed on your website, you explicitly acknowledge and support the land back movement. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit how you see your farm fitting into this movement and maybe more broadly, the future of food on this continent.
Land back is, if anyone's ever read the paper, land back is not a metaphor. Highly recommend it. But it's not. It's not just this like ethereal idea, right? It's this idea of reestablishing, in my opinion, like a central role for Native voices to be heard in land use policy and environmental stewardship approaches. And this land, being that it was stolen, and that stealing through maybe misinformation and deceit. So even though we signed treaties and stuff, I don't think there was a lot of well-informed decision-making and education in that process, and then outright theft. We rent land, and so it's just, it's complicated, but I think the farm can really like play a role in reestablishing a intergenerational, steady, consistent, long-term access to land for us to continue to practice, continue educating, continue just demonstrating traditional ecological knowledge and those approaches to land stewardship and practicing our cultures, engaging in our traditional diets, and really making that possible to pass on and on. As much as I don't like the private land ownership process or private property idea, that is where we are here and now in this society, in this time and place. And for us, that's especially for the Northwest, our first foods are very perennial, very well established. Those Oregon white oaks I talked about, you know, they live 200 years. They have quite the lifespan. And so to be able to protect land and space for engaging in those activities, it's really important that we have also the very real land back of actually having control and ownership of the land.
I wanted to also ask you what it was like. I saw you have a land acknowledgement on your website. It reads, Good Rain Farm is an organization led by and in service of Native people. The farm is located in the northern Willamette Valley near the so-called Portland Metro. We acknowledge that we'll always occupy land that holds the history of settler colonialism and trauma, including, but not limited to, genocide, poverty, oppression, forest removal, and land theft. What was it like writing this land acknowledgement, given your own unfolding story of reconnecting with your people and culture?
Yeah. Writing that land acknowledgement, it was an interesting experience. As an Indigenous person who's been displaced from our original lands, whose creation story comes down through the Portland metro region, which is where I currently cater. The farm is established here where I live, where we cater our customers. Portland, Oregon being one of, and Clark County also having a very large, in the top five large native urban populations on the West Coast here. And yeah, that was such an interesting experience because it's like, how do I acknowledge myself or like fellow tribes from being displaced from our land that we're on? But there's some great guidance out there I link to on that land acknowledgement page for further reading, education, and resources, how people can continue to contribute to those activities.
You said that you rent the farmland right now. Is there any future where you get it back?
Yeah. Ideally, I would love to put that into a trust or into the hands of a native tribe in the area. And be able to pass that down generation to generation. And the farm is just an economic model in which we can continue to move towards modern and new technologies, but also bring with us our teachings and our worldview and our practices that really, you know, exhibit reciprocity and relationship with ecologies and really decenter humans and really embrace a whole ecological farm, a whole ecological food system, right? So really returning back to some of those food forests and gardens and aquaculture, but also, you know, there've been great advancements in technology, and I don't think we're gonna, I think those are great. Like they allow us to do more things, maybe more ergonomically or safely or efficiently. So bringing that all together, meshing that all together in a way that our ancestors could be proud of and know that we're feeding community actively is really important for me. So I think the farm can be a really great conduit for intergenerational growth and futurism of indigeneity that way.
I really, really appreciate that answer. And it has me thinking about how the action and activism that we've seen and what some people have called alternative food movements or local food has really just been a starting point for a lot, and one that's received to date a lot of criticism, either for being too small to matter, or perhaps that, and this I think in some cases is a legitimate critique, that, you know, who is it serving? You know, is it serving to maintain settler hold of the land? Is it just serving communities who can afford more expensive vegetables? But your farm centers social justice, your farm centers decolonizing diets. And I think that there's a real lot of significance there. So how do you respond when you think about the future of your farm and sort of these critiques that have emerged around alternative, or maybe we can call them oppositional food movements?
Yeah, I think it depends on how you define a small farm, how you define like environmental farming, sustainable farming. I think it depends on a lot of ideas of what you define as success and thriving within current late stage capitalism. We're still navigating the system. And so it is very difficult, and it's very difficult to be capitalized to be able to invest in infrastructure, labor, and tools on the farm. And we've struggled with that. I've struggled as a female indigenous farmer in our area to access resources, knowledge, and support in those very fundamental ways to start a business. But we're also doing it. And I'm doing it after the model of so many other farmers out there who are doing a great job. Soulfire Farm is one of those out on the East Coast. And so we've followed in these large footsteps on how we can model and continue to support our community while also putting dignity and livable wages on the work that we do. It's still a learning process. We're still growing and exploring. But a few of the ways that we do that for our CSAs specifically are through what we call payment pathways. We have a variety of ways for people to engage and pay with us. We do our own in-house scholarship fundraising, and that is either through seeking out grants ourselves or in partnership with other nonprofits, or just funded by our community who wants to support us and see us thrive and support our other community members who maybe don't have that financial resource readily available.
So you mentioned CSAs or community supported agriculture. Can maybe this is a good opportunity for you to tell us a little bit about what you have going on your farm.
Yeah. You know, currently our farm, Hasquia Good Rain Farm, is only 2 acres total. And we are serving 150 CSA members, community supported agriculture members, and then some wholesale on the side. We also run a Save Our Seeds program, which is a seed education and rematriation program. Because many hands make light work and you can't do all of this alone. You need community. So SOS was a way that we could both disseminate knowledge around saving seeds and indigenous stories. And that's threaded through all of our work here on the farm, because we focus primarily on indigenous first foods of Turtle Island in our CSA veggie boxes. But all foods have a story that is original to its peoples. So I'm also a bit French. A lot of French fur traders here in the Northwest. And so that ended up part of my heritage as well. So we grow a lot of those brassicas. January king cabbages are very similar to some French heritage cabbages and turnips and radishes that grow really well. We're at the same latitude line. So sharing those stories and helping everyone, right? When we talk about decolonizing diets, decolonizing themselves, re-engaging with their ancestry and heritage, and encouraging everyone to kind of check out all of those is really important to some of the work that we do, because that really helps break down whiteness as this like big homogeny, right? This conglomerate, and breaks it back down into like all our unique traditions and cultures and places we come from, and those stories of how we got here. And I think that's so important for us to discover and go through.
So I know that you focus a lot on accessibility in your programs, and my sense is that your community has really bought in and is part of what's making it all work.
Yeah. So last year when we implemented sliding scale payment, we had our market rate above market rate and below market rate. And the exact same number who paid above market rate subsidized, supported the community members who supported, picked the below market rate. So that cost balanced out. So it made it accessible. This is our community actively engaging in a mutual aid economy, in this cooperative economy, to like support each other without knowing each other, without needing information, feedback, any extra hoops, right? We don't do any extra forms, make anyone pay or fill out forms to prove their need. We just trust that our community is going to select what they can do and give and partake in. And that's so important for us to reduce the barriers to access to our food without judgment, without explanation. And it's been such a great success, because it's really allowed us to continue to grow while meeting our mission of equitable food access in however people want it. One of the things we heard were folks wanted home delivery too. So that we have a cost to that, but also allow that to go into payment plans and to be covered by scholarship funds as well, because we recognize not everyone can easily move about this world and access our drop points. So being able to make it more accessible by going to direct to their doorstep has been really great too.
Your comment about the people paying above and market rate offsetting those who would pay below, seeing that balance out like that must have been really validating to the model itself that it works, right? And exciting. And I could tell you're excited about these programs, and I could ask you about any of them, but I wonder, is there something in particular that you're most excited about?
When I decided to name the farm Hasquiet, which translates to good rain, I had actually reached out to my grandmother. And she's always been a bit distant about talking about our indigeneity and where we come from and who we are. And so I was a bit nervous approaching her. But she had also been doing a lot of family tree ancestry stuff. So I knew she was excited to share this hobby she's been doing. So I used that as my in, and I got loaded up with books and photographs and multiple pages of birth documents and death documents. And we were talking, and I was like, what do you think if I named the farm in Sinai? What if I called it Hosquiet? And she's like, that's really cool. And then she told me, I had no idea that they had spoken the language in her household when she was growing up. So she was able to recite a few words, not a lot. We're all still learning as a family, but it was really cool and something new to learn from her. And that those little moments have been the most exciting and important parts of running this farm of Hosquiet. I've been able to reconnect with other Sinai people. There's not, you know, a lot out there, or we're not easy to access. And so when folks see Hosquiet, they're like, hey, you're Sinai, I'm Sinai. Like, we're from the same space and place. And that's so cool. And it's so cool that you're doing this thing and promoting it and putting it out there. Because for the longest time, I felt kind of alone, right? It was just me and my family. And I didn't know if there was a greater community, a larger tribe out there that we could connect with. And it turns out there is. They're just a bit scattered everywhere. I went up to a training in Olympia, Washington, where I met a mother and daughter, and they introduced them in Sinai. I introduced myself in Sinai. At break time, we got together, and I was like, did I do it right? Did I say that right? And they were like, we don't know. Like, the language was near extinct. So, like, just trying and saying it and putting it out there is keeping it alive and keeping it from going extinct. And sounds great. You're doing great. Like, keep it up. So it's really funny to, like, explore this space where we almost lost it all, and to be reconnecting and finding others who are also reconnecting. And we're just all just cheering each other on and celebrating that. And yeah, those moments are the most exciting parts of running the farm.
It's a really wonderful story and successes so far. Thank you for sharing those stories with me. And I hope that it continues to be that way for you and grow the way that you hope it does. Thank you for joining us. It's nice that we could connect this way.
Yeah. Thank you, Limlet and Sinai.
Thanks for joining us. Today we spoke to Michelle Week of Good Rain Farm. This episode of the Second Transition podcast was produced on the treaty lands and traditional territories of the Mississauga of the Credit, also known as the Dish with One Spoon Territory. The Second Transition podcast is supported in part by the Arrow Food Institute and in part by Voicehead Radio. See you next time.